doxazo, and it's not hypsao, it's basileia and basileus, it's kingdom and kingship. But again, the same theology of the cross, the paradoxical glory of God and the power of God, which always makes me glad to be a Lutheran when I read this. And those who were, in verse 39, and those who were passing by perhaps began to blaspheme or kept on blaspheming him, Canuntus, as they shook the heads of them, as they shook their heads and said, here's a acting like a vocative, it is a vocative, the one who is destroying the temple and in 3 days building it, so the one definite article governing both those participles, Sozen Seoton, save yourself. That's how you know it's evocative, because now we have a second person singular imperative, aorist imperative, Sozen. Save yourself if you are the Son of God. And katabethe, here's this odd aorist imperative form of katabino. It looks like a passive, it's not. Come down from the cross. Interestingly, the accusation that Jesus will destroy the temple and build it again doesn't occur in Matthew. I mean, Jesus never says that in Matthew. He only says it in John, in chapter 2. But it's part of the false accusation that's brought up against Jesus in chapter 26 before Caiaphas. However, the theme of the destruction of the temple is very prominent in Matthew, and Jesus himself has predicted it and spends the largest part of chapter 24 predicting the events that will lead up to the destruction of the temple. So this seems to me to be an example of something where the reader knows something that's not involved in the story, that the Christian reader of Matthew knows that Jesus said something like what's recorded in John 2. Otherwise, it's hard to have it make sense. Paul? No, he doesn't. No. Exactly. Yeah, there are some gaps, in a sense, if you will. Now, again, the reader will be able to link it up with all of the judgment which has been predicted against the temple. But this explicit, you know, prediction occurs only in John. That's a good question. The destruction of the temple, certainly, right? The kataluoing of the temple, because that's the same verb in the beginning of the eschatological. Not one stone will be left upon another which will not be kataluoed, you know. But the, you know, it's an interesting question. You know, in John, Jesus is the temple, right? He's the new temple. That's not real strong in Matthew at all, if it's present at all. So it's like you have a Johannine saying in a gospel that doesn't promote that same particular theology. Although he is Emmanuel, he's God with us, the presence of God among his people. Simply something greater than the temple is here. Yeah, right. So anyway, yeah, it's a good question. I'm not sure I know what the answer is. Oh. Dave Schmidt, did you see his list of prof speak, Paul? It's a very useful tool. Somebody asks a question in class and you say, you know, you've raised a very important question, we simply don't have time to go into it right now. That means, I don't know. and there's about 8 examples of how to say, I don't know, without saying, I don't know. So, Paul, you've raised a very important question into which we do not have time to go at this present time. I don't know. Verse 41. Likewise, also, the chief priests... Oh, the irony is so thick you could cut it with a knife. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross. It's precisely because he is the Son of God that he's not going to come down from the cross, right? And this recalls Peter. And by the way, this is the voice of Satan. You know, Satan in chapter 4 who tries to deflect Jesus. Satan in chapter 16 who through Peter says, Hilaos, Kyrie, mercy, Lord, this will never happen to you, after Jesus has predicted for the first time the passion, Right? Now this is the voice of Satan again. Come down from the cross. If you are the Son of God, right? Jesus is the Son of God. He doesn't come down. Likewise also the chief priests, as they mocked him with the grammarians and Presbyterians, kept on saying, he saved others, himself he is not able to save. Well, sort of, but he could call 12 legions of angels, but how would it be that the scriptures would be fulfilled if he did that? Again, from chapter 26. He is the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross, and we will believe in him. Once again, the irony is clear. It's precisely because he doesn't come down from the cross that his disciples and the reader will believe in him. Interestingly enough, I think this is a place where you can detect perhaps some Semitic grammar, and you can tell me if I get this right, Paul, but this katabato, let him come down now from the cross, kai pisteu zamen, and we will believe. I was reading that one time and I thought to myself, maybe there's a little more going on in there, and I remembered the narrative chain of an imperative plus a while plus an imperfect expresses purpose, right? Did I get that right, Paul? So, come down, almost, I think it may be valid at the very least to get the sense, come down now from the cross so that we may believe. Interestingly enough, the parallel in Mark has a henna clause. Mark actually has a purpose clause at this point in the narrative. Well, that just strengthens the irony. It's precisely because he does not come down that. He does not come down so that we may believe in him. Then verse 43, Psalm 22 is all over the place here in now a strong allusion, as you can see from the side note. Pepoithen, he trusted in God. Risastho from Riomai, the aorist imperative, middle, I suppose. Let him save him now, athele autan, this looks odd, if he wishes him. Thelo can mean to delight in, also if he delights in him, for he said, I am the Son of God. And now we remember the voice of the Father from heaven twice in the Gospel. This is my Son, en ho eudokeza, in whom I am well pleased. He is well pleased in the Son. He does delight in him. Nevertheless, he will not rescue him. This is the working out of Zechariah, the Zechariah passage. I will strike the shepherd. That's Yahweh speaking, right? I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. Yahweh is striking his own son here. Verse 44, and the same thing also, the thieves, the ones being fellow crucified with him, are in the same way they were mocking him. One didzan autan. Of course, Matthew does not have the penitent thief included, so it wouldn't be appropriate to preach on that and bring that detail in on this text, at least. Verse 45, from the sixth hour, darkness happened over all the land, earth, I think it's probably land, as in land of Israel, until the ninth hour. And peritein henatein horan, and about the ninth hour, Jesus screamed with a great cry, saying, Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani. And now Psalm 22 again. This is, my God, on account of what did you forsake me? Here's where the stuff really, I mean, we've had all kinds of Christology thus far. We've had Son of God, we've had King of the Jews, we've had all ironically proclaimed by these characters who mock Jesus as he's crucified. Now we have, this is the drinking of the cup. This is what it meant when Jesus spoke of the cup that he would drink. Here he's forsaken by God. 47, certain of those there standing, when they heard, they began to say, quote, this one is calling Elijah. The hati there is the recitative for the quotation mark. Elijah, this one is calling. Well, he's not either calling Elijah. We know that because Elijah already came and they did to him whatever they wanted, chapter 17, right? But this brings an overt eschatological note into this text. They think he's calling Elijah. We already know that eschatological Elijah has come, right? And they killed him, and now they're killing the eschatological king, the very Christ himself. And the eschatology will come crashing in a minute in more explicit ways. And at once, one out of them, Dramon, aorist participle from Trecho, what's something you could never guess unless you looked it up or memorized it, ran, and taking a sponge, he filled it of wines, and Perithes, he wrapped it around a kalamo, a stick, and he epudded Zenoton. He gave him a drink, or tried to give him a drink. And the rest were saying, Aphis, let, or hold up, let us see, Idumen, let us see if Elijah is coming. Now here's, I like this participle. You don't see many future participles in the New Testament. Sozon auton. This follows the classical rule that future participles often express purpose. And that's exactly what this is doing. And it translates perfectly. Let us see if Elijah is coming in order to save him. Right? Verse 50. Elijah doesn't come to save him. Jesus again cried out. After he cried out by means of a great voice, a loud voice, he released the spirit. He let it go. Verse 51, now come the eschatological signs. This is the reign of heaven manifesting its glory and power. This is the king of the reign enthroned, right? And God the Father, this is God's action in history. I learned this phrase from what's his name over there that reads Hebrew, that when earthquakes and cosmic signs occur, it means Yahweh just showed up, right? See, so the cosmos reacts now to this great deed, this great saving deed that God has just done. And behold, the curtain of the temple was split from above to below into two. And I think in context, the primary meaning of that is to be matrixed with the predicted destruction of the temple. So it's primarily a sign of judgment, although I think the flip side is also true, that the temple cultus is abolished and the sacrifice of Jesus is, you know, fronted for faith to trust. And the earth was shaken and the rocks were split. Now a little bit of a difficulty, like how exactly did this happen? And the tombs were opened, verse 52, and many bodies of the having fallen asleep holy guys were raised. And after they came out of the tombs, after his resurrection, metaten egers in autu, they entered into the holy city and they were manifested or appeared to many. Now, you can envision this in a couple of ways. One is, right away, the sleeping holy guys got raised and they sort of played cards or something from Friday until Sunday. So, is that what happened? Or, I think there's three sequences here maybe. So they were raised right away, but they didn't come out of the tombs until Jesus was raised from the dead on Easter. Or the tombs were opened, so that happened right away, but they weren't, the holy people, the saints, weren't raised and come out of the tombs until Easter. Or the whole sequence doesn't happen until after his resurrection. Now, I don't think it matters too much. I think the way the sentence flows, it seems as though the tombs were opened right away, even that many of the bodies of the saints were raised right away. But again, I suppose you can work that however you want historically. But once again, it's God's end time power. Resurrections, right, occur at the death of Jesus. This is the power of the new age. This is the kingdom of heaven at work here with the death of this man. Verse 54, and the centurion and the guarding guys with him, the ones watching Jesus with him, idontes, when they saw the earthquake and the having happened things, feared greatly, saying, truly this one was the Son of God. Now, we're out of time, but I just like verse 55 because and 56, because there were there women, many from a distance looking, who followed Jesus from Galilee in order to serve him, among whom were Mary the Magdalene and Mary the of Jacob and Joseph mother and the mother of the sons of Zebedee. And I like that last note. Matthew's the only one to say the mother of the sons of Zebedee. She was there who had asked for the two places of prominence for her sons. Whether or not she understood it when she saw it, we're supposed to understand that we have just seen the king enthroned and the two people sitting on his right and his left in his basileia. Nice touch. Way to go, Holy Ghost. Well, this is salvation is what it is. I mean, how could you not preach terrific gospel and good law on the basis of this text? If you have any problems, go see somebody else. I'm kind of busy. Time to stop.